Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. If you've ever been a caregiver, you might have wondered, how much can you give of yourself before it's too much? And what do you do when you reach your limit? Tara Ebrahimi gets at those questions in her piece, A Sister's Comfort, If Not a Cure. It's read by Nazanin Bonyadi, who stars in the new movie Hotel Mumbai. It's playing now in select theaters and nationwide on March 29th.
The first time my younger brother, Tekin, said his teeth were falling on the floor, my family was concerned. But we believed it was a passing manifestation of anxiety from the dental surgery he had recently been through. When he complained that his teeth were sliding down his throat and that he didn't have a mouth, we exchanged uncomfortable looks. But when he started walking around with a mirror in his hand and his finger in his mouth for days on end, we knew hoping for the best was no longer sufficient. Within 6 months, Tekin had lost both of his jobs and had become violent at times, throwing dishes and grabbing the steering wheel and swerving the car when riding with my parents. "You're not doing anything to help," he'd scream at them. "I'm in pain, my teeth are gone, you don't care." My parents took him for consultations to see if other dentists recommended more procedures to deal with his mouth pain. But it was clear to me this was no longer about dentistry. "Enough," I said to my parents. "We need to consider psychiatry." Although Tekin had been found to have development delay and fairly severe ADHD at a young age, he had managed to lead a normal life well into his teenage years. He stayed in the school system for as long as he could, participating in work and life skills programs. He was doing data entry at the airport and held a steady part-time job as a greeter at Trader Joe's. His situation was complex, as is often the case for people who fall into the gray space between severe intellectual disability and borderline development delay. He knew he was different from others in their early 20s, recognized that he didn't really have any friends, and that he would never go to college as his two older siblings had. He wanted nothing more than to get his driver's license. But he was happy at times, especially when he was socializing. Then he had the dental surgeries, and it was as if a switch in him had been flipped. After a series of root canals and teeth extractions, he woke up from his final round of procedures and anesthesia and was never the same. My parents emigrated from Iran, and my siblings and I were born here. Typical of immigrant families, there's a cultural disconnect between generations, and this is painfully evident in our conflicting attitudes towards the mental health profession. I am a proponent of its benefits, while my mother and father are skeptics. According to my relatives, exercise and diet are all you need to alleviate anxiety, and socializing and parties are the only treatment for depression. But now even my parents were worried, and they were willing to try anything. So we began seeking psychiatric help for what eventually would be referred to as Tekin's psychosis and delusional thinking. Because of his previous diagnoses, he was already in the social services system, which in our state consisted of a labyrinthine series of hoops and hurdles and bureaucratic insanity that not even the most educated and competent can easily navigate. After years of trying new caseworkers, psychiatric programs, and all kinds of medical and mental health doctors and specialists, my parents had reached a point of paralysis. They were lost in a system they didn't even believe in. They had become almost as lost as Tekin. So I took over. I'd never given much thought to social services. As a political issue, it was near the bottom of my list. As a healthy, educated, upper-middle-class woman, I cared about the economy, student loans, education, and, being a first-generation Persian-American, foreign policy. My crash course in this world was sobering. For months, I neglected my job and my own mental well-being in dogged pursuit of fixing my brother. I spent my days and nights researching what to do for him, contacting other families, sorting out his benefits, dealing with Medicaid and calling programs. I made spreadsheets and lists. I came up with a plan of action. And then another one when the first plan failed. And another when the second plan failed. The day Tekin grabbed the steering wheel of my car while I was driving my elderly grandmother in the back seat, I went into panic mode. Something had to change now. So I drove to the emergency room, where we waited 8 hours for him to be admitted to the psychiatric ward. During his 2-week stay, I visited twice daily, spoke with his therapist, and made an outpatient plan with his caseworker. I knew the medications he was on and had been on, the whole complex history of his teeth and his delusions. I knew every detail and had told the story so many times to so many people that it felt like my own. One day, his caseworker said to me, "What you need to understand is that he's not going to be fixed. He'll have good days and bad days. He's trying. But don't ever forget that he is a person. He isn't just an illness." I had forgotten. When it was time for Tekin to leave the psychiatric ward for an outpatient home, a halfway house for people with mental illnesses, I called a dozen times a day and could never get a response on the status of his anticipated stay. So he never went. After he was released from the psychiatric ward into my custody, I was unable to reach his case manager at the hospital despite my constant phone calls, emails, and voice messages, which were alternately kind, threatening, and pleading. Although Tekin had moments of lucidity and progress, they were few and far between, and becoming ever fewer and farther between. I didn't know what else to do. I was scared and tired and felt like a child who needed an adult to lead the way. So I gave up. There, I said it. I gave up. It was just too much work with too little payoff and far too sad. So I dropped the whole thing. No more doctor's appointments, no more meetings with caseworkers, no more hours spent researching facilities and programs. "You're weak," I told myself. "This is your brother. He has nothing and you have everything." But I just couldn't do it anymore. Helping him seemed to require that I lose myself into his care and cause. And perhaps it's shameful, and perhaps it's not, but I could no longer do that. Still, I lay in bed at night worrying about what would become of him. I cried and had panic attacks and prayed to God to send me help. But really, what good would it do for Tekin? It would make no difference in his quality of life. Slowly, I adjusted my thinking. I asked myself, What are the things in my power I can do to make him happy? Instead of creating spreadsheets and placing fruitless calls, I took him shopping for cool clothes so he could feel more confident. Rather than taking him to doctors, I took him out to lunch every other week, whatever restaurant he wanted. I invited him to parties and barbecues I organized at my house, included him in conversations, cracked open a bottle of beer for him, and treated him like the 23-year-old dude he was. We made pizzas together. We cleaned out my car. We talked about our parents. Sometimes his finger was in his mouth and sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes he was quiet and lost, and other times he'd laugh and tell stories about something funny our father did. Those times when he was deeply mired in the darkness of his mind, I didn't think my presence made any difference or brought him one millisecond of joy. But other times, when he would smile the way he used to, I knew that even if he couldn't understand or express how he felt, spreading tomato sauce on dough was a nice, fun thing for us to be doing, and I loved him for giving those moments to me. Once, at an assessment for a mental health day program, a specialist asked him, "What do you want for yourself?" Takin shrugged, as he often did. "Come on, Tak," I pressed. "What do you want?" He thought for a moment. Finally, he said, "I want a normal life. I want to work. I want a girlfriend. I want a car. I like people. I want some nice friends." I had to turn away as he spoke, because I knew I couldn't give him any of those things. "I'm tired of this pain," he added, finger in his mouth. Then he laid his head on my shoulder and left it there for the remainder of the interview. I bore the weight of my brother's head on my shoulder as best I could. For as long as I could. It wasn't much, but it was something.
That's Nazanin Bunyadi reading Tara Ebrahimi's essay, A Sister's Comfort, If Not a Cure. We'll catch up with Tara after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Tara Ebrahimi is 34 now, and her Modern Love piece came out 7 years ago. Her brother recently turned 30, and Tara says that though he's doing better in some ways, he's declined in others.
He is struggling with pretty severe obsessive-compulsive disorder. You know, he struggles with depression and a slight psychosis in a couple of other ways, and paranoia and things like that, but what I find incredibly interesting about his situation, and I think what makes his situation really unique and actually very hard to deal with, is that, you know, he's developmentally delayed. He's really incapable of expressing himself in the way that you or I would be able to, which makes handling his mental illness much harder, and it makes it almost impossible to really diagnose him in any sort of meaningful way.
Takin lives with his father in Virginia and has for the past decade. He has helpers who tutor and mentor him, but he struggled to get and hold jobs. And since this piece came out, Tara has moved to Chicago, but she did recently go to court to become one of his guardians.
Myself, my father, and my mother are all co-guardians, which is not only a legal responsibility, but it's also the kind of responsibility where you can no longer say, I'm going to live my own life. I mean, my life is now incredibly entwined with his and will be for the rest of my life. That's obviously a tremendous responsibility and a tremendous burden.
Tara visits her brother often and sometimes spends long stretches of time with him to help take the pressure off their father.
Just last summer in July, I spent 2 weeks in Virginia, just me and him, and it was definitely the hardest 2 weeks of my life. He struggles with severe agoraphobia now, but he also has really severe ADHD. So you're kind of in this really tough place where, you know, he gets bored really easily because of his severe ADHD and he can't entertain himself. He doesn't want to watch TV. He doesn't want to play games. He doesn't want to read. He doesn't really have the attention span to do any of those things. But at the same time, he can't really go outside. So it's this constant struggle of what are we going to do today? I mean, I remember waking up in the mornings and it would be 6:30 in the morning and I would think to myself, how am I going to get through the next 15 hours?
Tara says that the bottom line is that her brother is not going to have the kind of life she would want for him.
He has moments of happiness and joy here and there, but, you know, frankly, they're few and far between. And I think that his life is a hard one. You know, he wants a girlfriend. He wants a job. He wants friends. And these are things that he will never have. And I think part of dealing with the sadness that comes with that is acceptance and knowing that there's not a lot that I can do to change those things, but there are things I can do to make sure that when I am with him, he is happy and having those moments of joy.
As for what the future looks like for them, Tara says it's uncertain, especially now that her father is in his late 70s.
I'm not entirely sure what's going to happen, and it's a very scary thing for me. My plan is to bring him to Illinois, where I live, and to kind of get him into the mental health care system here and to set him up in some kind of group assisted living facility. And just, you know, that's where he will be, and I will be the one looking after him and the one taking care of him, but not the one who is going to be providing that day in and day out care, because frankly, I'm just not equipped to do that.
And she's not sure how she'll balance everything when she's married and has her own children.
Luckily, I have a partner who's very understanding right now and knows that Takin is going to be a huge part of my life forever because, you know, I'm not going to ever give up my brother.
Tara Ebrahimi. She's a writer and editor and is currently working on a book about her relationship with her brother. She lives in Chicago. More after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, says this essay gets at a lot of questions about caregiving.
How are you going to spend your time? Are you going to spend your time managing and resenting it? Or is maybe a better expression of love enjoying that person's company? What are acts of love? What do people want from us? And what can we give? Those are the questions that this essay asks. And she arrives at a place that sort of comfortable and seems to be better for both of them.
And here's Nazanin Bunyadi.
The thing I connected most with in this piece that really spoke to me was Tara's journey in helping her brother was so human, and she cares so deeply about him. But we're all, you know, we will have a ceiling that we hit, and that doesn't mean we aren't helping others. It's just the best we can do.
Thank you to Nazanin for reading this week's piece. Her new movie is Hotel Mumbai, playing in theaters nationwide on March 29th. Next week, Natasha Lyonne of Russian Doll.
Manhattan may have a scarcity of affordable apartments and parking spaces, but apparently it has no shortage of older widows and comely divorcees, many of whom wanted to date my newly widowed father. Whenever I visited him at his Upper East Side apartment, it was not uncommon for us to be interrupted by the doorman calling up to say, "A lady just left a bundt cake downstairs." "What am I supposed to do with all these women?" he would say. "I feel bad, but there are just too many."
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Anya Strimian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.